Hello, you are listening to the Modern Web Podcast, where we explore next generation frameworks, standards, and techniques. I'm Tracy Lee at Lady Leet on Twitter, and you can find us online at modern-web.org. All the reset starting over, but will it work in the browser order? Have better luck with the four leaf clover. We are very excited today to have two really awesome Ember community members on the podcast. We have Jeff Biles, who is the founder of Ember Screencast. Jeff, do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself? Tell us what you're up to these days.
Yeah, so I'm spending a lot of time trying to make great screencasts that teach people how to use Ember. And I'm doing some other educational things, writing a book, doing some trainings. Really enjoy helping other people get to know this tool that I love.
Cool. And we can find you on Twitter. Is it at Jeffrey Biles?
Yes, it is.
Awesome. Perfect. Charles, I know that you do a lot of amazing things with the front side and you're down in Austin eating all the yummy barbecue. What are you up to these days and what should we know?
Okay, well, my name is Charles. I'm a software developer at the front side. I'm pretty old as software developers go. I've been about 20 years of experience in the industry, and I've been doing specifically UI for about 10 years. So I was a back-end developer, but then around 2003, I moved over towards doing front-end development, and that started out mostly in Java, a little bit of like C++, really old like desktop applications. But more recently, it's been JavaScript and it's been the web, because the web is just such a fantastic and exciting platform. And within that ecosystem, using Ember, because I just feel like it is the most productive and lets me focus on what it is that I love to do, which is taking really cutting edge user experiences and finding out how to make them real. So that's who I am, and that's what gets me going.
And we can find you on Twitter at
CowboyD.
Great, awesome. Well, lovely. I'm super looking forward to hearing this interview. And Jeff, I'll let you take it from here.
All right, that sounds great. Thank you, Tracy. Charles, one reason I wanted to interview you is because of all that experience that you have, the 20 years working in different paradigms. And I know that web developers, typically, we don't have as much experience doing real, quote unquote, real programming, since JavaScript, the ecosystem, is so young. So you've worked in a lot of different paradigms. And one thing that's impressed me is that you're not, even though you use Ember, you're not comfortable just doing exactly what they say the happy path is all the time. And one of the things I've noticed lately is that you've been taking some of the functional programming paradigm that has been used heavily in things like React, and you've been bringing it to Ember.
Yes, that's true. Well, first of all, it should be noted that there's already a lot of functional stuff that's present in Ember to begin with, right? There's not much, people will put computed properties forward as examples of pure functions where the dependent keys are essentially your inputs. But the other thing is, if you kind of strip away the, you kind of strip away the terminology, you see that, at least in the way that I was brought up over the last like 10 years, MVC is very much, despite having kind of an object-oriented, was given that name from Smalltalk, which is kind of the quintessential object-oriented language or object-oriented environment. It's very functional in nature, in the sense that you have these data structures, your model, and then that your view is 100% dependent on the model. In other words, the form that the view is going to take. It's a one-way relationship of causality between the model and the way that the view is realized.
Right. So the view is a pure expression of the state of the model.
Yes, precisely. And so that is something that kind of came down to Ember from classic MVC and something that was already there in MVC. So, you know, while to some people this may be controversial, because, you know, if there's one thing I have learned in the last 10 years is that people will argue about what MVC actually means and what's MVC and what's not MVC, and everybody's got their take on MVC, but at least...
I mean, it depends on if it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday.
Yeah. But the definition that's been most useful for me over my career is really to focus on focus on getting your model right, and then writing the view is usually pretty easy. Because it's this one way mapping. And that was the same when I was doing Swing. It's the same when I was doing Qt and WX Windows. And it's, you know, it's something that I always aspired to, even when I was doing jQuery stuff and Backbone stuff.
Mm-hmm. So in Ember, does the M for model and MVC match up directly just to the models in Ember and Ember data? Or does that include the route and controller as well?
I would say that the model in Ember is the data that's loaded from the route combined with the decorations that happen inside your controller and your component, right? So you have this model, and there's this, you know, clear chain of dependency between, you know, the actual core data and the values, which are either mostly computed properties, which are derived from those values. So that I would actually kind of consider all of those layers. I wouldn't consider the route a model, but the thing that the route materializes certainly is, and then everything that you layer on top of that to derive further values, I would also consider the model.
So the core model is like the head of an octopus, and the different computed properties that are in the controllers and elsewhere, those are like the arms.
Clearly. What the world needs is more analogies for MVC, but the octopus model works for me.
All right. And so the view and controller, how do those map up in Ember in your mind?
Well, so the controller I would see to be an extension of the model. Essentially, it's a read-only layer that decorates for the most part. And then, you know, I would essentially see the, you know, again, this is my personal take on MVC that works for me and the way that I think about it and or have come to think of it. But I would see the controller in Ember being comprised of really part model and part controller. So the actions would be controllery, and the computer properties are modely. So you have these properties that are derived from your core model that's loaded in the route. And I would consider those really, those are model. But then the imperative code is where it would be your actions.
All right. So it sounds like the things that are, to use the new data down actions up paradigm that we stole from React, the data down, that would be the model. And the actions up, that's the controller.
Yes. Yes. So you have like, you know, these, the model is not, the model is, the model is essentially static data combined with pure functions to derive values. And then, so that's kind of the functional part. And then the imperative part, where you're actually kind of setting, you know, kicking off that first domino, or, you know, setting the wheels in motion, that's the action. And that's kind of what has historically mapped to the controller. What's considered the controller?
And then the view is the templates and the places where it collects the actions.
Yes.
Collects the user input.
Right.
All right. So it's interesting that with the data down actions up, which I'd been told was less MVC, it's actually becoming more MVC based on your understanding of it.
I think it's, yes. I think that's fair to say. I don't know how helpful it is to like rearrange the parts so that it's like classical MVC, but I don't think that I think that people who are kind of declaring the death of MVC really haven't been around to see kind of what all MVC has entailed over the last 40 years and what it's meant to I mean, it was already a storied pattern with a lot of different takes and a lot of different interpretations when I showed up on the scene. And so I'm only even talking, you know, I think a lot of experience with it, but I mean, you know, the MVC pattern was initially like written when I was 5 years old. So it's really, and you know how old I am. So it's really old.
So we've established that even though Ember is thought of as we'll say object-oriented framework. It's really very functional. It's becoming even more like one of the classical versions of MVC.
Well, wait. This is a little pet peeve of mine, because I do feel very strongly. It's important to note that the opposite, functional programming and object-oriented programming, are not opposites. I would say that functional programming and imperative programming are not opposites. I still haven't figured out exactly what's a good opposite for object-oriented programming. I'd probably say non-distributed or something like that is a good opposite for object-oriented programming. So object-oriented programming is intrinsically distributed. In other words, these things only communicate through messages. But you can have the individual objects themselves internally can have as much FP as you want. But for me, the actor model is the opposite of functional programming. Well, maybe. But anyway, that's a digression. But I often catch myself pitting those as opposites, and I think that's actually not true. I think you can be very, very, very functional and still be object oriented.
Right. And that's true within Ember as well.
Boop-a-loop.
I have noticed a trend lately, and you've been pushing this as well, to get even more functional programming than Ember offers out of the box. And I've seen a lot of this happening within the templating layer. So let's talk about how we're turning handlebars into Lisp. Because I think this is great.
Okay. So, I've just spent a bunch of time talking about how, I think that, Ember has a bunch of functional concepts that OO and functional programming are not mutually exclusive. That said, there is a lot of formalism around functional programming that can be very useful in certain contexts, because what what functional programming I've come to kind of discover over the last year or two is that it's really fantastic at composing tiny little bits, little computations together, and stringing together with each other. And we see this, all over the place. So, the classic example is like your shell, and doing basically pipes that where you're clicking together tiny little programs, each one that takes the output of one program and feeds it onto the input of the next program, and you can have any number of transformations in the middle, and you find that it's very easy to compose things in novel ways.
Right, and you guys actually created a pipe helper over at the front side, right?
Yes, we did. And that was because, one of the things that we found was that there were certain transformations that would happen on an action where we essentially wanted to massage the data in certain ways, add things to one list, take it from another list, map a value off of one thing before we handed it to the action on the route that was actually going to save it to the database. It was going to update the model. It was going to do any of these other things. And as it turns out that, when I talked about these formalisms surrounding functional programming, those already are essentially pre-existing. They're on the shelf, and you find them in languages like Lisp and Haskell and even JavaScript, although not quite to the degree that you find them in things that are pure functional languages. So you have these functions, and so there's really two things that I want to get at, although they are related. And so one is, in order to make these transformations in that kind of pure functional way, which is a good, you could do it with computed properties, where you essentially set some value on an action, that computes a property, that then computes that property, then that computes that property, that then you consume inside of your action. And that has two disadvantages. One is that chain of transformation is hidden from you in the template. And so you have to switch contexts in order to grasp the entire pipeline that a value is going to be traversing before it actually gets to the action. So you see it in the template. You see, oh, this component is going to fire an action, and then I'm going to take that, and then I have to transition to the controller, and then I have to kind of trace with my eye the set of computed properties and the dependencies, the dependent keys that are associated with each one, and then I can kind of trace that computation back. I might, you know, my eye might look at 6 different computed properties, maybe just 3, but you know, inside of a JavaScript file, that's pretty verbose, and it can be a little bit difficult to grasp. And that might not be, you might think, well, that's not much overhead. But what if it's something where you've got someone new who's coming onto the project, and they don't know which controller this is in, which route is this is in? Whereas if you've got it right there in the template, and you see, okay, I'm composing these 3 values, I'm establishing this one pipeline, you know, I'm going to take this value, I'm going to take the, you know, maybe I've got a list of files, I'm going to take the first file off of that, I'm going to take the file, the name of that file, and then I'm going to put it in an object, and then I'm going to fire that into an action. If I can see that little kind of pipeline, boop, 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 all 4 sitting right next to each other, then you know, I can determine exactly what's happening just by glancing in one place. And the thing is that handlebar sub-expressions are so much more concise than JavaScript, because you're literally just writing down kind of a list of symbols that reference actual JavaScript functions or actual helpers. And so, you know, we've actually found it to be extremely, extremely helpful. The other thing is we find it to be more bug-free too, because there is no keeping track of dependent keys, because Handlebars does it for you. So you're free to rearrange the actual pipeline without at the same time having to do this secondary rearrangement of all the dependent keys. So if I want to shift this pipeline, I have to change the names of my computed properties, and then every place that appears, I have to update the name of that property, and anytime it appears as a dependent key of another property. And so in Handlebars, it keeps track of the dependent keys for you. You don't have to worry about it. The computation is the computation, and you don't have to kind of manually grind out this meta layer of like, hey, these are the ways that the values are connected to each other. No, it's the values are connected to each other merely by virtue of writing them out in the template.
So what I'm hearing is that it does 2 things for you. One, it reduces the overhead, both in writing it and having to specify every dependency, as well as when reading it, because you don't have to go to a separate file and look at 4 different functions. And the other thing is that because this is part of your UI, it keeps your entire UI in one file.
Yes. Yeah, so what the composition of your UI, it basically gives you like a roadmap of your UI. So all of the heavy lifting is still done by action. So if you've got to like update the model, and you've got to do all this other stuff, and you've got some heavy lifting to do, save to the database, do all that stuff, that all is going to be still happening in JavaScript. But you're able to make a very lightweight reference to that action and just put it inside of a pipeline of like, these 6 things are going to happen. Boom, 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 boom. And so it's, again, it's about that very clean composition, that very clean and lightweight composition. So, you know, I think of it as not so much writing my UI, but as composing a UI out of very small parts. And so actually having, you know, contrasted with the MVC, having a very strong functional formalisms actually, you know, enables that composition at a very small scale.
So it sounds like in the controller, the component JavaScript file, you're specifying what Legos are available. And then in your sub-expressions, you're just putting them together on each action.
Yeah, I think that's a good way. I think that's a good way to think about it. Although one of the things that we've been finding is more and more, we're actually trying to move values out of the controllers and out of the components and get them into the template using helpers. So one of the things that we're doing is we're moving away from components and moving away mainly from components where we don't need them, and moving towards helpers or
towards doing helpers?
Towards doing helpers that yield a value, basically capturing a value from a helper and then yielding it into the scope. Because that's the other kind of drawback with, because so the other thing that's about, the other thing about functional programming that's different kind of the way that Ember has classically done it is that it's, you know, it's related to things like, you know, here people toss around terms like lexical scoping versus dynamic scoping. Well, a handlebars template very classically has been very dynamically scoped. So values just kind of magically appear into templates. They're magically provided by the properties of their controller or the properties of the component.
And so helpers help make that less magical?
Yeah, and that they make it less magical. In other words, you can say, like, you know, we have a helper. I used it in a blog post recently called for creating an object URL, where you pass a blob to the helper and it returns a object URL corresponding to that thing. And so you say basically, like, with object URL for the blob as URL, and then you yield that into the scope. We don't need a computed property on a component. And it's very clear what's going on in the template. It's not like it's, you know, it's not like, it's actually very obvious what's happening. I'm taking this blob, I'm converting it into a object URL, and then I'm going to use that object URL in the template. So there's no magic URL property that just appeared. I can look at the template, I know exactly where that thing is coming from.
Right. And using a helper like this is strikingly similar to how functions work in a pure functional language. You put in whatever your arguments are and a value pops out.
Exactly. So it's very clear that the flow of data and the flow of consequence and what values are going to change what other things. If it's tucked away in some component, then, you know, it's not going to be, it just takes that much longer to parse the template, and, you know, it takes that much longer or that much more mental overhead to kind of reconstruct the chain of consequence in your head.
Right, because a component, it can change the state rather than just spitting out a value. And so that's why they're inferior for this, right?
Right, yeah. It's very obvious which values are there in the template, and so you can, it encourages you, if I've got a helper that just yields a object URL, then it is going to encourage me to have other helpers that take object URLs as their input, and then in later places be able to compose those two things together. Versus if I'm doing a one-off property inside of my component, well, I could make a helper that consumes that value, but the tendency is to kind of just want to do it in the component anyway. And so you end up kind of struggling for where you're, you know, struggling for the ways in which you're going to, you know, reuse these transformations of values.
Because they're hidden inside various JavaScript files.
Exactly. And so sometimes your tendency is to use a mix-in or something. So you mix in a set of computed properties that assumes some antecedent some antecedent property that they're going to compute off of. But that kind of obfuscates even things even further, even though you've got that reuse there. Whereas, you know, if it's you're encouraging the values to flow inside the template, then being able to click them together inside the template also comes more naturally.
And this is still fairly powerful. Like, if this is the first time you're hearing this, you may think it's not what you're used to, so you can't do everything that you want to do in it. But you guys have made a to-do app just in Handlebars, right?
Yeah, so Alex, who also works here, he... and he gave a talk at Austin Ember ATX on this. He made an entire to-do with create, update, and destroy using nothing but handlebars. And I think it was something about like 7 lines of handlebars, 8 lines of handlebars.
It was extraordinarily pretty short.
Yeah, it was very short. Well, because it shows you that there's not much to this, right? Adding something to a list, removing something from a list, and changing the thing that's in the list. that's... You know, there's actually not much there, and it doesn't need to be that hard. And that was with just a very few helpers. It had the pipe helper, and I think there was an append and remove helper, and then a set helper.
You guys have made those helpers available, right?
We were working on an Ember add-on to do something just like this to make these helpers available that we've been using internally here. And then Dockyard actually came out with an add-on called Ember Composable Helpers. So we're going to try and see if we can't bring the things that we thought were special about our add-on to that add-on.
Yeah, that's awesome that you guys are collaborating about around that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's still early days yet, but I'm pretty excited. I think this is actually pretty important.
Right, and what I saw in Ember Composable Helpers combined with what I saw in Ember Curry Helpers, this is definitely enough to move a lot of the basics into your handlebars without writing your own helpers.
Right, right. And you can make... I wish there were a way you could define handlebars helpers using nothing but handlebars code. but that might be a little bit crazy. But where it really shines is when you're handling actions, I think is where it really is helpful. And you're able to set up these pipes where you've got the action, you've got the value coming out of the component, and it's not in exactly the form that you need. You just need to massage it and transform it. And that's where it really shines. One of the things that was special about the Ember Curry helpers is that you can actually, the helpers themselves actually support currying. So if you want to include, where this is nice is let's say you have an add, in Alex's example, there was a, what was it called? I think it was called an append helper, which basically appended a value to an array. Now, interestingly enough, these helpers were immutable. So that didn't actually mutate the underlying array. It just returns a new array that has the value at the end. But where it's really valuable in the pipeline aspect, a lot of times what's cool is let's say you have like this append helper that takes two arguments. It takes a list that you want to append to, and it takes the item that you want to append. The item is not going to be available, right, until your action fires. But what you can do is you can essentially curry the helper and drop it into the pipeline and provide one argument, which is the list, and then the second argument is provided by the action. And it's just nice. I mean, you could do this with... I believe you could do this with using the action helper. The actions have been curryable for a long time, but what's nice is when the components themselves are curried. So in other words, if I have a helper that takes two arguments and I pass it one argument, what it computes is a function that takes one argument. Whereas, so you can curry with actions, but it's also, if you don't want to sprinkle the action keyword, action, 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 on everything that you want to curry, it's nice if these helpers have the ability to curry natively.
Ember Composable Helpers doesn't have that yet, but it may in the future if you have your way.
So there's a couple of challenges, because the library that we wrote is not basically backwards compatible with things like Ember Array and Observation. It is purely functional and does not use observation at all. And so it doesn't work with mutable data. But we've also moved away from mutable data. So the question is, you know, if we're going to be collaborating, you know, how do we try and merge those two worlds so that we have a set of helpers that works with mutable data but also doesn't? Well, there's some drawbacks.
Right. So if you're not using mutable data, then you can do some more powerful things. But most people in the Ember community are still using using mutable data.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which I would recommend against.
Boop. Right. So how do people stop using mutable data? What's the process look like for that?
So the process, the things that I've actually been talking about, we kind of got it a little bit backwards in the sense that it was actually a commitment to using immutable data that kind of started us walking down this path. And so, you know, here we are talking about composable helpers and curried helpers, but really, if you wind back, the story really, for us at least, starts with, you know, trying, like we were talking about at the head of the conversation, or maybe we were, maybe we weren't. but, you know, I was looking at a couple of different React-based frameworks and how they handled state and how they basically never changed the state in place. They just always replaced the existing state completely and totally wholesale. So the way that I would say you start with doing things like immutably. And I should, like, there's a whole conversation, a whole meta conversation. Actually, I'm going to be giving a talk on it at EmberConf, about why this is a good thing. But the way that you would start down the path of, immutable state is just a simple commitment to inside your actions, never set state piecemeal. Always do it whole meal.
So always replace the entire thing.
Yes. Yeah, so what you, in the same way that, Think of your components as like your controller, where when the route transitions, you're replacing the model. You have that model hook, and it gives you the whole model. That's, for the most part, an example of kind of immutable style thinking, whereas like each transition has its own state. Now, inside actions, then sometimes you'll find people setting data directly on the model. But think of it like this way. Imagine you had a component. And then your component had a model. And in each action, you were never allowed to set a property on your component. What you would do is you would generate a new model and then set the model that had, if you had 10 properties, you'd set a new model that had all 10 properties on it. And you know, maybe when you're constructing it, you pass in the old model so that it can say, well, I'm going to copy the values off of the old model minus what changed. And so, but what you do then is you never set just one property. You never set, two properties by themselves. And by replacing the model each time, every time there's an action, you get a brand new model. It allows you to, it kind of safeguards you against non-determinism or getting into a state that you have not anticipated. Because eventually, essentially, you're going to have to be calling a constructor at some point, right? You'll be calling a new constructor every single time that you handle an action, or every time you have a state transition, you're going to be creating a brand new object. And so you're going to be passing it some parameters to the constructor, and those parameters are going to, you know, perhaps derive a bunch of other values, but you're starting from kind of a single point, which is that constructor, and then fleshing out the rest of the object.
Right. So instead of having a state machine that has 10 different states and you have to know how to move between each state, you just have to test whether each state is good.
Well, you could still have 10 different states, and you still have to have, you can think like of your action as a state transition, but I guess you encapsulate the entire state in an object.
Right. State machine probably brought up the wrong thing. So you have an object, and instead of having to figure out how to transition from, like, what happens when this value changes, you have to say like, oh, well, we'll just restart the entire object.
Yeah, so exactly. You don't have to say, you basically don't have to do a diffing process inside your program.
Right. Yes, that's a much better term than
I'm in state A and I want to get to state C. How do I modify state A to get to state C? But have that same bit of code be able to figure out how to go from state B to state C or from state C to state A.
Right.
That's a great way of thinking about it.
Now we're in state C.
Yes. Now we're in state C, and you just instantiate state C and you set the state onto the object. And that's really kind of, that's the way that React works, right? That's the kind of the simplicity of it. And so that, I would say, is the very first step. And it's a really easy step to do. Because right now what we have is, you know, kind of classic Ember is that state is just mashed into the component, right? It's kind of distributed out through that those properties. And so your actions have to basically figure out that diff. Right? Or you can almost think of it as like an animation. I've got two states and I need to figure out how to tween. I need to figure out how to tween between them with JavaScript code. But if you require it setting the new state, and you can do this with, it could be an Ember object if you want, but really what we've discovered, and that's the way we started too, is basically making these kind of pure, I'm using scare quotes, pure Ember objects that were nothing but computed properties. But then we're like, well, heck, we could just use these could be POJOs that have, you know, computed properties that are ES5 getters. And because the ES5 getters, because the state will never change, the underlying properties from which the computed properties are derived never change. You can just use a dynamic ES5 getter and you don't have to, there's no dependent keys, there's no anything. And so we've used those extensively. So now we're replacing the state wholemeal, right? So if, like, let's say we've got some autocomplete component and we've got properties that are like, say, whether the little pop-up is showing, maybe we've got a query string, maybe we've got like a property that says, is it pending? Like, is it, you know, currently talking to the server? Things like that. So the kind of the next step, or so the way that you would model that is you'd have this object, which is essentially like a autocomplete state, which has all of those properties. And every time some action comes in, you create another one of these objects and you set it on the component, and then the template renders. Every time an action comes in, maybe every time a key press, that counts as an action too. You create a new state, set it on the component, and it renders. So, and what that actually encourages you to do, because you've now because you have this whole wholly formed state, it just follows so naturally that you have a component whose only job is to yield that state into the template and let other components hook into it. Do you see what I mean? Like, I basically now have this object that perfectly encapsulates the state of my workflow. And so really what I want is a component that's not there for markup, but it's there to just yield this state into the component and, or sorry, into the template, and let other components that happen to be coordinating inside this template use that value.
So it's an even further separation of concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then you might have like a pop-up component that pays attention to the, you know, the is open state, or a text box that looks at the query state. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, and this sounds like it would be fantastic for the add-on ecosystem, because you can just create a tiny little part of it that can be used in 20 different situations.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's kind of how we started down this road of like realizing, oh, there's, you know, you know, we've got all these components now that contribute very little markup. Their only purpose is to yield a stream of states into the template that can be composed with other helpers that have their own states that are partially derived from that antecedent state. And so, you know, that's kind of, you know, you iterate over that and you iterate over that, and, you know, your components get smaller and smaller, and you have higher level of composition. And then you find yourself asking the question, well, why do I need a component here? Really, it seems like what I want is, you know, I just want to capture a single state from helper. I don't need any associated markup. And so a lot of times that's the way you end up going.
Yeah, that sounds like once you get your head around it, which I'm still working on, it sounds like it's much simpler once you figure it out.
I certainly think so. And here's a nice kicker. I was going to mention this before, but I'll mention it now. This style of work, not necessarily with the helpers, but of emitting a stream of whole meal states, that works really well pre-Glimmer, it turns out. Unless, like, what's I found the most interesting thing is, because we actually have one client who's still on an Ember 110 app, and, you know, our kind of thinking had evolved based on, you know, all the stuff that was happening out in the community, Glimmer, React, all these things. And so you know, exploring this immutable style and this way of modeling. And then we were like, well, we should try it on a, you know, a pre-Glimmer app. Turns out that if your component isn't that big, it works fantastically. There are a few gotchas in that the HTML is torn out and brought in each time.
Uh-huh.
And
so you have to be very larger components.
But we're talking, unless you're talking about huge lists, basically, which was the big thing that everybody was concerned about.
Already, right? A problem pre-Glimmer.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, this style actually works really, really well.
Speed-wise, in a post-Glimmer world, is this an improvement for speed?
You know, I would say, I don't know. I haven't taken any benchmarks. But in terms of speed of development, absolutely. And in terms of, you know, like, certainly in terms of the weight that needs to happen, like the weight of reactivity, when you're using just regular old JavaScript objects. Because what's cool about that is you know, when you replace an entire state, you're basically saying this whole thing needs to be recalculated. Because it's not listening at the individual property level. Those properties might still be the same. But what it is, it's listening at that very top level. So you're replacing an entire tree. And so, I mean, I don't know. It's certainly, there's a lot less time spent in the run loop updating and traversing these things. Observer chains. Yeah.
But it sounds like it hasn't slowed it down significantly.
Oh, no, no, no. That we certainly have not had noticed. There's nothing been, you know, all I can provide you is anecdata. And that all speaks to it hasn't been a problem.
Awesome. And so where do you see this going in the future?
So the biggest thing that I think I would like to see come out of this is that a lot of things that I've been talking about are not framework specific. So remember, one of the things that, you know, I was talking about is you have these helpers, which are essentially purely functional. They take an input, which is some piece of data, and they yield an output, perhaps like over and over again. There are ways that you can abstractly capture a workflow, both in terms of the model, in other words, the valid set of states, and the actions that operate that cause the state transitions into those other states. And there's a way to encode that is not Ember specific. It's just JavaScript. And that's actually what we've done with a lot of the libraries that I've been describing. So we actually have an autocomplete library. We have one. I don't know if it's worth mentioning. I did a blog post about doing a file upload that had the object URL helper. It also had a XML HTTP request helper or a component. But the thing underlying that is just a plain old JavaScript library. Impagination, which is this kind of infinite scrolling.
And really cool.
Yeah. That is at its core is just a JavaScript library. And it works, it has bindings for Ember. And so there's an Ember component that will yield one of these things into, basically yield impagination states into its template. But the kind of the core magic is pure JavaScript. So we actually have developed probably about three or four components that where what we've really encapsulated is a state machine, an observable state machine, so that as the state transitions, you can get a callback and to this new state, so that then you can render a stream of states as they happen, which is what every, you know, which was all of the modern web frameworks are really good at, whether it's Angular or Ember or React, whatever. It's like, if you give me a state, I'll render it, and it'll be awesome.
Mm-hmm. So even though you've made these things initially for Ember, someone could, with a little bit of effort, transform them to be usable in Angular and React as well.
Yes, because I believe they're basically these observable state machines that are independent. The autocomplete workflow is independent of a framework. It's really independent of a rendering system like the DOM, and that's why you can actually make it just in JavaScript. And so that's what we did with impagination. It's what we did with the request, and we actually have a form library too, a form validation library that's pure JavaScript that we've used in two projects now, and hopefully we'll get to open source that later. But there's always a million things to do, but one of the things that I would love to see those libraries get used in other ecosystems. I mean, there's no reason you wouldn't be able to do it in jQuery. There's no reason you wouldn't be able to do it in Node. Certainly the things like the XML HTTP request will only work in the browser, but that's the only prerequisite. Everything else, it should work in any
framework.
Right,
the general patterns can still be used in Node.
Yeah, no, I could totally imagine doing this in jQuery, right? But having this kind of immutable model and this workflow, and then, you know, every time the model changes, you just render a component with jQuery. So really separating out those micro machines or micro models or something like that. I don't really have a good term for it.
The functions?
Well, it's more than just a function, because it really is it's a state machine, which is a set of a set of states, or it could be an infinite number of states, and that then you have a predetermined set of actions that cause this state transition. And it's really, really simple, and it's just ES6 classes and, you know, simple callbacks. You don't need things like Redux or you know any other architectural component. You really just need some very, very simple primitives to model these things. So I would really like to see an ecosystem of those kind of universal UI workflows emerge. That would be my dream.
That is an excellent future.
Yeah, and then be able to be able to use those in Ember. As far as the Ember specific things goes, I would like to see us go further down this rabbit hole of you know using helpers. I would love to see like the machines rose in the Terminator. I'd like to see the rise of the helpers come and exterminate almost everything else. I'd like to see kind of native currying inside the helpers, not just through the action helper. I honestly would like to see any JavaScript function that happens to be in your handlebar scope callable as a helper.
So if someone wants to help you achieve those dreams to kill everything except functions, how can they contact you to help you do that?
Well, I'm at CowboyD on Twitter. I'm CowboyD at frontside.io. I'm CowboyD in the Ember community Slack. I'm CowboyD on Freenode. So there's a lot of ways to contact me, and I always love hearing from anybody.
Awesome. And is there anything else you want to say before we hand back the mic to Tracy?
San Dimas High School football rules, if you're old enough to get that reference.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, guys. You can find us on Modern Web, modern-web.org, or again, CowboyD on Twitter. Jeff is at Jeffrey Biles or at Ember Screencast. And also, I saw a tweet from Brandon that Frontside is now available for some client work.
Yes, that's right. It's frontside.io. So yeah, anyone looking for custom UI development, in particular custom web UI development, we love to work on cool stuff.
Thanks for listening. To find more podcasts, videos, and online conferences, check out modern-web.org or find us on Twitter at modernweb_. See you around the internet.
CSS starts flying, and it works on every client.
Download Normalize.